Welcome to Ash Wednesday. That's a horror. My voice went, oh, all right, all right. Which is horrible because of how masculine our guest is. It almost makes me feel embarrassed to be here. This is kind of news to a lot of people, but we'll have a new show called Fearless at the Blaze, hosted by Jason Whitlock. Mr. Whitlock, thanks for being here, sir.
Good to be here. Good to be in Crowderland.
Yeah.
I like this.
This is the whole idea when we built this studio was we wanted it to be a space where people would actually want to hang out. You know, not like, if you've worked at ESPN, it's almost like the Blazing Saddles town where you get in, you're under the bright lights, and you're like, get me out of here.
That is true. You got your own video game I'm looking at, Steven Crowder.
Yeah, Steven Crowder. That was actually the least expensive item here. Yeah, it was just some guy who made it for us when I, like, all these other people. You know, when they build sets, they'll build super expensive sets. When we, remember we're first talking with this company, we're just hiring someone as a consultant. She's like, oh, okay, well, we get like a neon sign. I think we could get it for you for $15,000. I'm like, whoa. And she just said, well, we have a podcast that I think it might have been ESPN that has a pool table that's like, I mean, I want to say something absurd, like $50,000. And I just go, well, that's done. These bloated budgets are not going to exist anymore when you have Joe Rogan and an Airstream kicking your ass.
Pretty much, yes.
So, and you've been on all fronts. Well, first, actually, I'm going to light this
You're going to have to teach me how to smoke a cigar.
Okay, which is interesting because we were just talking about when I go to a cigar lounge, it's 50% black people, and then all the white people are conservative. But I don't think all the black people are conservative, but I've never once seen an argument at a cigar lounge. It's just kind of a great uniter where you can sit, talk, have a drink, calm down.
I think that probably everybody in there has shared values. I think that many black people are conservative, but vote Democrat because they've been programmed and trained that way. But yeah, a lot of people, my brother and his wife are into cigars,
right?
A lot of athletes, a lot of my friends are into cigars. I've never been into it, but you know, I'm always willing to try new things.
Yeah, there you go. We'll try something new. Yeah. All right, so I'll show you how to light it. Now, I always feel like an idiot whenever I'm teaching someone anything.
Let me grab a lighter.
Yeah, we'll grab a lighter. and that's a torch lighter. So what you want to do is toast the cigar all the way around. Kind of see like you want to toast the edges. If you get it lit the right way, where everything is lit, then you're not going to have burn problems. A lot of times you'll see people that just start like puffing on it. And what ends up happening is they don't light the cigar evenly and it canoes and it becomes a problem.
Mm.
Here, let me watch you doing it. There you go. Yeah.
But I see your whole thing.
Well, see when you blow on it? And this has a soft flame, so then I. And then once you light it, once it's all lit, then you take a couple of drags. You know, in from the flame. You suck the smoke in from the flame a little bit. Yeah. So now you put the flame up to it. Flame up to the foot. Yeah, now draw on it. And kind of rotate it as you draw on it. There you go. And let me see real quick. If you blow on it, you should see it should all be lit. And then you'll kind of see the little black spots. That's where you'll light it a little bit more. Yeah, for people who are watching here kind of on camera, I'll show you. A lot of people send me requests like, how do I light a cigar? I keep having problems. There's an easy trick is blow on it. And once it's all lit, yeah. And then you can just draw on it. And once you get it lit, it'll be good. And I'll as you finish that, I'll tell a story here. These are actually, they're from the White Shot. These cigars are Bellas Artes. Not an official sponsor by any means to the show. But cigars are an item that are finite. Like this, I think, is about age 7 years. You can't just make more of it. Like bourbon. And I've always...
I can't believe I'm not coughing, having pulled on this twice.
Really? Well, you shouldn't be inhaling it.
I'm not.
Okay, good. Yeah. No, this is a really nice, smooth cigar there, too. I think you're good. And is the draw good? Are you getting, like, you're getting smoke through it? Yeah, looks good to me. All right, there you go. So we're all set. Now that we spent way too much time on this, but let me... Because I have to thank people out there. AJ Fernandez, the people who make these cigars. I never wanted to recommend them because, like guns, there's a cigar shortage. And so I knew if I recommended my favorite cigar, I wouldn't be able to buy them. So not a sponsor to the show, but he did say, I'll make sure that I can always send you a box. So now I can tell you, Bellas Artes is an unbelievable, it's my favorite. I recommend it, very affordable.
I have lung cancer tomorrow. I'm blaming you.
Well,
I'm blaming you.
Blame all those years coal mining. What are you going to blame me if you get CTE too?
Won't blame you for that. But look, I'm glad you got me some Casa Dragones too.
That's a
I'm tequila, sorry. Yeah, right? I love this tequila.
Okay.
And so that's going to help me smoke this cigar. And that, I think, because again, I'm a lightweight. I'm not a big drinker. I used to smoke weed in college, but that was in college a long time ago.
Jason.
A long time ago. And so don't cigars give you a little bit of a buzz?
A little bit, but it's more comparable to like coffee. You know what I mean? And if you inhale it, it'll make
I don't drink coffee.
Well, I'm saying it's more of a mild stimulant. Is that good?
I got this cigar has made my tequila taste even better.
Well, you know what? That's a big thing. It's like pairings, like wine with cheese. So there, and I'm not a big drinker either. My wife, thank you so much. She bought me a bourbon.
Oh, that's good.
That was like almost $100. I've never had that in my life. And I think now I'll only ever drink $100 bourbon. It's so much better. All right. So Mr. Whitlock, we had you on the show a while back and the reaction was like intense how much people liked you. And the word that kept coming back was authentic. People really liked your authenticity, which I mean, it's always a good quality, but it seems to be something that people recognize with you. And, you know, I've talked about this before. I think what it is we've talked about how you have a lot of conservatives. And sometimes if they're like black conservatives or gay conservatives, you know, which are atypical, a lot of the times they come up to the ranks and right away they have a show or they have people think that they have something to gain. When you came out with your views, and I don't even want to say conservative, as a Christian sort of, you can say traditionalist, however you want to define yourself. I mean, you stood to lose a lot. And you did it anyway. And I think that's why people really gravitate toward you.
I hope that it's my authenticity. And I hope that I would think there are people in your audience or your audience. There's a lot of synergy because, one, I've been in the sports lane. Mm-hmm. Sports, the values taught in sports are pretty conservative. And so there's a great synergy between sports fans and conservative.
Well, what do you mean by that? Because I mean, you know, people will look at like, you know, the Colin Kaepernick and what the NBA
That's
is
the
now.
New sports world.
Okay.
What sports have been for more than 100 years has been a celebration of Americana, mm-hmm. and a representation really of what America aspires to be. A meritocracy, colorblind, unifying.
I thought you were going to say rich and black.
No, because that's football and basketball.
Well, no, but that is most white kids now. If they could be anything, they want to be rich and black. They want to be. That's they're all trying to act like they're hip hop moguls or athletes. LeBron, you know, this kid, every kid looks up to them. Which to me, growing up, I grew up kind of in what we would consider a post-racial America. Certainly more so than today. I mean, I had pictures. I didn't even play basketball. I just had pictures of Michael Jordan on my wall. You know what I mean? It was one of those. It didn't really matter. It seemed like a meritocracy. And nowadays, because people are so gun shy, I think people are moving away from that sometimes. They're scared.
Well, I think we're moving away from our Christian values in this country. And I've been on a little speaking tour where I've been trying to explain to people, like, you think cancel culture is about conservatives or Republicans or Donald Trump or Steven Crowder or Jason Whitlock? What's being canceled is Jesus. Mm. This whole racial thing is a way of moving people away from their Christian values.
Yeah.
And you're hitting people that are trying to be beholden to their Christian values, and you're labeling them as racist.
Yeah.
So now they're less likely to espouse their Christian values because they've all been defined as racist.
You would think that black Americans are Republicans when you look at where they line up on things like social issues, you know, a lot of the social values. And certainly they're the moderate wing of the Democrat Party today. But why do you think that, that sort of wedge works with black Americans when they're, you know, predominantly compared to white Americans, it's very secular. Kind of the black American culture is the one place where most people would still identify as Christian, but sometimes they buy this stuff, hook, line, and sinker.
Well, I think it works because of our history. There has been a reason for us to consider our race as something that America uses against us. And so we have placed a higher value on our skin color than we probably should. And we've been susceptible in this new era to identifying more as black than Christian.
Yeah.
We prioritized our skin color over our religious faith, and that's a mistake.
Mm.
And I think if you understand the history of America, the African-American journey has been the steroids for American greatness. And so if you go all the way back to 16, 1700s, the sin of slavery and the black people's fight for American freedom made America live up to its best ideals,
yep.
made America live up to what was promised in the Declaration of Independence and what's promised in the U.S. Constitution. And so our history is something we should be celebrating and not looking at as like that it damns America.
Right.
We should be looking at it like, no, your history made America great.
Yeah.
Your pursuit of freedom made America live up to its best ideals. You're essential to American greatness, and we thank you and have gratitude and respect for that. And let's don't cover this all with shame and it's damning of America. Especially
too, because so many white Americans shed blood to make sure that we ended the unique sin of slavery. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this. I was from, I was raised in Canada. I was born in Detroit, raised in Canada. And when I started this show, I guess about a decade ago when it was on radio, someone called in and said something, and I don't remember, but they listed the year. And they said, you know, my so-and-so grandfather, I don't know how many generations back, said, you know, fled to Canada. And I did the mental math. There was slavery in Canada. A lot of people don't realize there was slavery, obviously, in the English Empire long after we abolished it. Not in just Britain, but not in England, but the British Empire. And I said, oh, you know what they would have said in Canada if you fled there? Great, more slaves. Because it existed there. We did, though, we are singularly unique in fighting a really, really bloody battle to end it. And it's one of those things that I think people overlook when even they look at Jefferson or Washington and people who always saw it as evil. This idea that it was unanimously accepted. Look, it was unanimously accepted by slave traders in Africa, for example, was a business that had gone on. And it was a way of life, but a lot of people in the United States always had a problem with it.
Even people like Jefferson, who owned slaves,
right.
He knew it was morally wrong and needed to be corrected, and that's why he wrote the Declaration of Independence the way that he did. You and I think are both friends with Glenn Beck. Have you ever seen Glenn's got rough drafts?
Oh yeah, from Barton.
The Declaration of Independence.
Yeah,
that show you what Jefferson really thought about slavery, but we couldn't get two of the colonies to sign off.
And they couldn't
version.
Free their own slaves until death. And so there's. Have you met David Barton? You know Glenn Beck.
That's
his friend with all the historical documents. Oh man, I would go there, and he has this building where it's, you know, basically hermetically sealed, humidity controlled, and he has all these old documents. And because I'm often an idiot with important things, I'm always nervous. Like if it's someone who's really important, or if it's an object of great historical significance, I always get nervous that I'm going to break it. And he'd be like, oh yeah, this is, I don't know, could be like, this is Jefferson's diary, and this is one of the original leathernecks that they wore. You know, he'd talk about the Navy and the Marines, where the terms come from, and actually fighting off Islamic pirates, and be like, here you go, and he'll toss it to me. Like, whoa, 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 whoa. He has so much there. It's like a bat cave of history. I wanted to go back though to something you mentioned about sports, kind of, you know, conservative values, and that kind of goes to something that I've always said this, even if you look at rich white liberals, like in Hollywood, entertainment industry, they claim they're liberals, but they don't live like liberals in the sense that they work really, they just feel guilty. So a lot of them don't want to accept that their work ethic or their skill, their talent has brought them success. Let me ask you this. How many years did you play in the NFL?
I did not play. Played college
football. Oh, you played college. Sorry, I played. Yes. Well, see, this is how much I know nothing about sports.
Gotcha.
But then you commentated, obviously.
Commentated. I made my bones as a journalist.
So college ball. And you played 5 years, did you?
Four.
You played four, and then
took me 5 years to graduate from college.
Okay. Well, I'm just getting, I'm 0 for 2. But the point here is, did you feel like people were discriminating against you based on race when you played college ball? Did you feel
no.
like a racist environment?
Look, did I see some racist acts as a college football player? Did I experience some? Yes. You know, we had a black guy and a white guy on our team, and I liked both of them, but they got in a fight with each other at a party, and the coach kicked the black kid off the team. and we all erupted.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, man, this guy was at the fight.
Yeah.
You know, this is crazy. And we got the guy reinstated on the team.
Was it like a mutual fight? It wasn't like a jumping or anything like that?
No, it was a mutual fight.
Yeah.
It was a mutual fight.
That's
it was. And look, I like both of them. I'm still friends with both of them today, 30 years later. But we erupted and was like, hey, man, this is BS. And they had to let the Andre back on the team. Look, we played against, I won't name the kid's name, but we played against the team that the defensive tackle that I was blocking the whole game called me the N-word throughout the entire game. And I just kept looking. I knew guys on the other opposing team.
That's stupid.
Yeah.
Has he seen you?
Well, he
doesn't seem like a smart move.
It wasn't. But he's a defensive player. I'm an offensive lineman.
Oh, so you wouldn't meet up.
Yeah, we were playing each other against each other. I was blocking him, and I would look over at his teammates on the other. They played for Northern Illinois. I look over at his teammates like, "What is this clown doing?" Because he's on the defensive side. It's a more black side of the ball. He's huddling up with, if there's 11 defensive guys, probably 8 of them were black, and I'm like, well, "Y'all."
That's
letting-
one thing that I will say that white hockey players got right. No other sport has this. You know, I've talked about this. I don't know how much you know about
drop
hockey.
The gloves, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the ref lets it go. They've changed it now.
Yeah.
But actually, a friend of our family, hopefully won't mind, I've talked about him before, Stu Grimson, really solid Christian. We actually met him at a place called Hockey Ministries Camp, where it was for often underprivileged youth, or they would have like grants where kids could go and they would do Bible study and then they would also do hockey practice. And Stu Grimson came in and he was an enforcer in the NFL. And that was NHL. His only job. Yeah, this thing keep going. It's because you're talking. It's okay.
No, no, we're good.
But you know what? There's a beauty to that. It's sort of self governance. Where if this guy was calling you the N word, you know, in football, if you could have had a ref tell you to, all right, drop the, well, not gloves, but take off the helmets and go, that would have been a lot better.
I kicked his ass the whole game.
Did you?
I got my
okay,
get back.
You got was, your
yeah. I got my get back, and we beat him, and you know, but yeah, the no place on the planet is perfect. Unfairness is a part of the world. Racism is just a derivative of unfairness.
Yeah.
It's just a form of unfairness. It's not going to go away ever. I cannot lose this argument though. No country has created documents like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and a system of governance that combats unfairness
right.
better than America.
And
that's all you can do.
And that's the biggest concern when you look at all great civil rights movements, whether you're talking about race or gender equality, the whole suffrage movement, we can go another. Women, I'm glad you got the right to vote without having to do mandatory draft, bucket duty, or pay taxes, okay? And we voted for that. A little bit different from civil rights, but they all were spurred by speech. The First Amendment, you know, these, everyone, whether you're black or white, and some people tried to abuse that, but ultimately these constitutional rights are what allowed marginalized people to speak out, raise awareness, and like you said, fix the unfairness, tip the balance back. And now you have a movement, white, black, I would just say it's really more so about elites versus us, the plebs, Americans, who want to make sure that you can't speak. And if you can speak, and they say, well, it's not a First Amendment issue, they want to make you afraid to speak. And they'll do it with you by calling you an Uncle Tom, like you've said. And they'll do it with me by saying, well, you're a racist. So I guess we're two peas in a pod, a racist hosting an Uncle Tom. I don't even know how that happens. A racist wouldn't be in a room with an Uncle Tom. I just, you know, but this is where we are now. And once you take that away, and right now, obviously, black people enjoy equal rights in this country, but who's the next marginalized community if you take away speech? Right now, you're talking about, I mean, for example, Taiwan. Or the people of Hong Kong, right? These are people who need Americans to speak out for them. And even though it's not against the First Amendment, the NBA has put a moratorium. We can't speak about Hong Kong. You know, we just had John Cena, who's all natural, by the way. John Cena apologized for acknowledging Taiwan as a country because of pressure from a communist Chinese government and big tech who are willing to appease them. I really am concerned that there are going to be people in positions of power who can pick what new civil rights movements are allowed to take place, which marginalized communities are allowed to speak. Taiwan, no, you don't get to. People of Hong Kong, no, you don't get to. Hamas, good. Get in the car.
You started this by saying white liberals preach one thing, but what they actually do for themselves contradicts what they, and the biggest thing I see, what drives me crazy is the white liberal with an ultra commitment to his family or her family.
Yeah.
And they're basically telling black people, family doesn't matter to you. We got a government check. Ignore that 75-80% of your kids are being born into a single parent home. Mm. Ignore all that. We got a government program that's going to fix that. Head Start is going to fix the fact that there's no daddy in the home. Right. That ain't the way they're living. They're not sitting there. They are committed to their families and will keep their families intact despite whatever dysfunction may be going on. Daddy may be cheating. Mama might be cheating. But we're going to keep this family together for these kids. They have the commitment to their family. And if there is no family structure, trust me, you're not going to grow roses from that. You're not going to grow success from that. And so it's like they're sentencing us, black people, to a dysfunctional family that can't produce properly functioning, supportive neighborhoods, communities, nations, anything. That's the hypocrisy.
Yeah.
They know family is the key to everything, but they want to tell us, now, you know what the key is? Stopping these lightning strikes of police killing black men.
Right.
That's lightning killing. Getting struck by lightning and dying happens as often as what we saw happen to George Floyd. God rest George Floyd's soul.
Sure.
And this is where I drive people crazy, because I've had a family member who I helped raise, a cousin,
yeah,
killed by police in Indianapolis in 2012 in what we believe was an unjust fashion. I get it. I know that pain. I'm not speculating. I know it. But that happens so rarely.
Right.
It's like lightning striking and killing somebody. But family breakdowns that create generational dysfunction.
Yeah.
We need to focus on that. My dad was alive and still running the Masterpiece Lounge. The coronavirus would have destroyed his business and his way of life.
He ran the Masterpiece Lounge?
The Masterpiece Lounge. It's a neighborhood bar in Indianapolis. What,
that's exactly the kind of business I would expect a black man to run. The Masterpiece Lounge?
He ran it well.
Surprises me zero. Do they have cigars in there? Probably not towards the end. Yeah.
It was my favorite place on earth. It's in the inner city in Indianapolis. It's why it doesn't matter how much ever money I've made or will make in the future. I'm always going to be a Masterpiece Lounge person.
Yeah.
And like working, because it catered to factory workers. Yeah, it's still there. I sold it to somebody else, and
they
run it, or maybe they've sold it to someone else, but it's still there.
I'd love to go visit it sometime. Maybe we could go do a walkthrough and see if it's like, you know, it used to be, if you remember.
I know the guy I sold it to invested some money in it, but yeah, it's still in the same neighborhood. It's in the hood in Indianapolis. It's not far from where my dad built a brand new home in the inner city. It's
God forbid it became an Applebee's.
Yeah, and I know it is. It ain't that. It's still the matter. And we had a backyard where we cook and grill. And when the Final Four would be in Indianapolis, I'd invite all the media to come eat and drink at my dad's bar. I'd feed them, drink them. We'd cook the whole nine yards. It's a black version of Cheers. And then occasionally, once or twice a year, whenever there was a big event in Indianapolis, I'd bring in all the media, all my friends in the media, and they get to see what this is how we do it in the inner city of Indianapolis. And people loved it. The food's great.
I can imagine. Yeah, that's what's
for
that's
real
one
drink.
Thing that that strong sense of community that you definitely get more in the black community than you get in the white community. And the reason for that is because, look, people use the term black and white sort of interchangeably. And this is where I have a problem with anyone who is actually a white supremacist, is I go, well, when people say white culture, look, you shouldn't be browbeaten or be ashamed to be white because it's not something you can control. But there is no real white American culture, because there's Irish American culture, there's Italian American culture, there's Polish American culture. Whereas black American culture, historically, there is more of a unifier. Because, like you said, of how they were discriminated against in a similar way. So there is that strong sense of community and culture, which I think a lot of white people are envious of. And I think a big part of that comes from, you look historically, like you said, strong family units with black families. I need to give you this book. I actually think Dave has it right now, the Joe Louis biography. That's my dog is named Joe Louis, just because not only is Joe Louis my favorite athlete ever, I don't think his title defenses in the heavyweight division have ever been topped. But a quote from him that I loved in that book, you know, he grew up in the South, Then he moved to Detroit. You know, people think he's from Detroit, but he's not really from Detroit. That's where he trained. And he said, maybe I was ignorant to it, but I grew up in the South. It was yes, sir, no, sir, ma'am. He said, I didn't experience racism there like people talked about. I had met racists. He said, but nobody called me the N-word until I moved to Detroit. And that was a shock. And what was, you know, Muhammad Ali called him an Uncle Tom, Joe Louis, because he was beloved by white America. Joe Louis was the most popular athlete in the country. When we talk about sports and race, I think this is something that a lot of people miss, and this is why Joe Louis to me is, and you can, you know, tell me if I'm way off base, could just be my white privilege, but think about Joe Louis fighting Max Schmeling. So Max Schmeling was sort of, they propped him up. It was like real life Rocky IV, right? He was the Aryan sort of example. First fight Joe Louis had with him, he lost. It was the only fight he'd ever lost. Then Joe Louis, contrast Muhammad Ali, you know, who ducked the draft and obviously was a conscientious objector, and that was a different story. But it's interesting because it's so antithetical to what happened with Joe Louis. Second fight, Max Schmeling. A lot of people don't know this. Joe Louis, I think only a couple weeks later, was going into World War II. He wasn't exempt because he was a celebrity. So he was about to go into World War II. He's about to fight the guy who Hitler is praising, Max Schmeling, the example of Aryan strength that will defeat the Negro American, you know, back then. And he got called by the president and said, you gotta win this one. You gotta win this one for us. It was the biggest sporting event in history at that point. Imagine the pressure on his shoulders. And he knocked out Max Schmeling, and all Americans cheered. And he was America's champion. Do you have individual racists? Sure. That's not a racist nation.
I'm gonna go a step further because Jesse Owens, just I think in 1936, Berlin Olympics, he basically plays a similar role as Joe Louis, dominates at the Olympics in Berlin in front of Hitler, becomes a national hero. Joe Louis, 2 years later, 38, knocks out Max Schmeling, national hero. And what people, there's nuance to racism. My dad did not like white people. You could call him a racist, and he wouldn't bat an eye. His life experience, things he experienced, made him not like white people.
Yeah.
My dad, one of my favorite human beings to ever be created, I idolized my dad. I never in my life saw my dad act in a racist fashion towards white people. And so there was something that trumped his racism in terms of his engagement.
Sure.
And it was like, because like a lot of people, they just want to be good people.
Right.
More than they want to be racist. They want whatever interest, whatever energy someone gave my dad, he gave them that same energy back.
Yeah.
So if you greeted him with respect, he's going to give you respect.
Yeah.
If you came into his bar, he's going to give you respect. He's a businessman. So I lived a different life than my dad. I played high school football with Jeff George and on an integrated high school team that was nationally ranked. We won the state championship. I had plenty of white friends growing up. My dad never, now again, he might privately say to me, man, I don't ever want you dating a white woman and blah, blah, blah. But when it came time to engaging, interacting with any of my friends, it was always respect. None of my friends ever felt his racism.
Yeah.
And it's because he wanted to be a good person. And so we have this little silly belief that if someone says something racist, they're that racist explains all of their actions.
Yeah.
Every, like, oh my God, he says something racist, therefore every act he takes is a racist act, or he's trying to advance the cause of white people over black people. It's just not true.
Yeah.
People are really complicated. They think and say really stupid things. There are some things I have done in my life I am so ashamed of. There have been moments where I have said things that would cast me as a racist. Anybody that knows me, like, man, Jason Whitlock ain't racist.
Right.
But have I said some things? Have I done some things? I bullied a kid, a white kid in high school.
Oh, you white boy punked him?
It wasn't even about that. It was more about I was a football player, and again, we played on this great high school football team. I was the captain of the team. This kid wouldn't get, we all donated 10 or 20 bucks, I can't remember what the standard was, everybody on the team to buy the coaches gifts at the end of the season. Mm-hmm. We win a state championship. We're the toast of nationally ranked, toast of the high school. This kid was on the team, gets a nice little state championship ring. He wouldn't give me the $20 for the coaches. He said, F the coaches, what have they done for me? So that probably happened in, let's say, November. The rest of the school year, from November until June, I bullied the shit out of this kid anytime I saw him.
The white kid?
White kid.
Yeah.
It's reprehensible. I still think about it today because I'm embarrassed to say a couple of the things that I did bullying him because it will make me cry.
But you didn't bully him because he was white. You bullied him because you thought he was wrong, but people could take interpret that as because he was white.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's something really interesting too, because right now other people will copy paste your motives. They'll say, "Oh, he bullied him because." And certainly, if it was a white guy bullying a black kid, you would never, ever. Like my brother, actually, he only got into one fight in his life, and we were raised in a. It's interesting that you bring this up, because if you meet my brother, he's the opposite of me. What's actually funny is I'm more of an introvert. I'm more shy, but I make up for it by talking with people. Whereas my brother's actually more social, but he's very quiet. Certainly not aggressive. And there was a guy, there were only about three black kids in his class, and one of them happened to be a real piece of shit. He was a bully. He had bullied my brother all year, and here's what happened. My parents, unbeknownst to me one time, we had turtles, and my parents didn't like them because they were gross, they carry all kinds of diseases. So my parents allowed them to be the class pet. And we came into class one day, and my brother's turtle was a class pet in the aquarium. And he was upset about it. But what happened is then the teacher said, we're going to allow someone to take the class pet home on the weekend, a new person each weekend, which was not supposed to be the rule. So this guy who bullied him, black kid, hated my brother, took the turtle home and then put him on top of his remote control car and drove him around and showed my brother like pictures. The next fire drill, when they're going down the stairway, my brother grabbed this guy. I can't say, maybe we have to bleep it. His name was my brother, who had never, ever been in any kind of an altercation at all, pinned him, and people could see because his head was dangling over the top of the stairway. My brother just started pummeling him over his turtle. They were friends after that. And the thing is, I was friends with that kid's little brother who was also black. But we all knew that that guy wasn't, he was the ass family. I guarantee you today that would be seen as a racial issue. It was that his turtle was being put on a remote control car and he was a kid and he felt powerless. You know what I mean? What can he do? The teacher wouldn't do anything, so he just got into a fight. And I just think of how scary that must be to navigate now as a kid. Like you said, there are things you look back on that you might cry over because you feel like you did something wrong. I have those moments. And I think, again, it gets to godlessness. There's no forgiveness now. We're looking to score a point and define someone by their biggest moment of weakness or of, you know, sin. And we don't, we selectively forgive people. That's really scary. Imagine being a kid today. You know, that would be all over Instagram.
And we're now looking at each other as fodder or a body to throw on a pile that we can stand on,
yeah,
and make ourselves bigger. And so we, and I don't want to send the conversation spiral in a different direction, but I'll just say it, but take Derek Chauvin.
Yeah.
I believe his actions were criminal and wrong. I don't think it was driven by race.
No.
And I think most people can understand that. And the reason why it's been racialized is because, oh, that'll make you popular over social media.
Right.
That will drive likes and retweets and blah, blah, blah. But if you actually watch the trial, race was no part of the trial.
Yeah.
And his, so even the people, the lawyers in court,
yeah,
knew that race isn't an issue here. But the entire media has made everybody think this was a racial case of police brutality, and it's just a case of police brutality. A guy, Chauvin, that handled a situation improperly.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
I don't know how you call that racist, but that's how, once they frame the argument, then everything that is on one side is racist. And everything that's on one side is altruistic. And I tell you what, I hate to ever be a pessimist, but like we've talked about sort of off air, without God in the middle, I don't know there's any coming back from this.
Well, Jesus, God, is the only solution. And like, if you really understand what Christianity, religious faith is, it's a pursuit of truth.
Yeah.
And they have effectively illegalized the truth. No, and that's why, again, if I'm saying Jesus is the truth will set you free. The truth powers freedom.
Yeah.
And so we're all sitting here wondering why, man, we feel less free in America than at any time that I, you know, for as a black person. This feels like 1963 before the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Right. We have less freedom now. And the only way to do that is to illegalize truth.
Yeah.
And the search for truth. And if in trying to understand the truth of what went on with COVID, what went on with Derek Chauvin, there are some uncomfortable, insensitive questions that have to be asked, debated, analyzed. They can't be illegalized. Oh my God, if you ask that question, you're racist. If you don't agree with our take that it's first degree murder or second degree murder or third, because I think most reasonable people, in my view, think Derek Chauvin should have been convicted of manslaughter. I don't think there's, if we had followed the truth wherever it led, I don't think it leads to second degree murder.
No.
And people need to be allowed to say that without being, oh my God, that guy, what an Uncle Tom and sellout. He does, because here's another truth. Now, I'm just sorry. May 25th, 2021 was treated damn near like it was the day Martin Luther King or JFK were assassinated.
Right.
JFK, Martin Luther King, I can't remember the day Abe Lincoln got assassinated, but these guys have resumes of work, of accomplishments, things they did, stood for, contributions to American society. Now, I'm sorry. Other than 9 minutes, I don't know what George Floyd contributed to American society.
We know how he harmed American society, and including his fellow black members of his community with armed robbery, not being there as a present father. And it doesn't mean that in any way that it justifies someone dying at all. But again, if you don't look at the truth, if you try and amplify the lie as a truth, you miss the actual truth. And then you go one step further, and the biggest companies that have ever existed feel that they've been given license to remove truth. Something else too, going back to, you know, even Jesus Christ was killed for what? Speaking. He was killed for words. He didn't actually commit any crimes, and his words were truthful, where he said, I am. That's what it was. He was executed for speaking truth. This isn't new.
And that's why I'm trying to, and it's one of the reasons why I partnered with The Blaze. It's one of the reasons why I want to continue our engagement.
Well, you said partnered with The Blaze. It sounded like you said parted with The Blaze.
Partnered.
Yeah, partnered.
I was partnered with The Blaze. Okay. And why I want to continue to engage with you, Glenn Beck, is that we need to, believers and people with platforms, we have to host a discussion so that we can expose to other believers who are being fooled by this whole racial warfare to understand the war is actually against Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And we need you to choose a side and to give in to your religious beliefs and never lose sight of them, because they're trying to blind you with race so you can't see the truth.
Right.
And the destruction of truth is the destruction of Jesus, and it's why our country is in the kind of chaos that we're in. It's been 60 years since we've been in this type of chaos, and to me, I was born in 1967, 1 year before MLK was assassinated. At that time, because of the progress that was made, I was born into what I believe was a very hopeful generation. Yeah. My parents were telling me and my brother and my stepsister and stepbrother, you can be anything you want. You can accomplish anything. And that kind of belief made it possible for Barack Obama, who's just a few years older than me, to become president of the United States.
Yeah.
And then to see in the aftermath of that, we've spent the last 4 to 5 to 6 years telling black kids, man, this systemic racism, you can't do shit in America.
Right.
And, yeah. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
I was in 1984, Stephen, me and my dad were in a 400 square foot, one bedroom apartment in the hood.
Yeah.
I slept on the couch. He slept in the bedroom. And in 2020, I live on the Wilshire Corridor in the richest strip of land in America.
I have to brag about it.
But I'm just saying.
No, I know.
The American dream is out there and available. If my little chubby ass
can well, come on, being little, you're being generous here.
If I can get it, and I'm just, I can show you my SAT scores. I can show you my GPA in high school and college. I'm not some genius. I didn't go to some Ivy League school. I went to Ball State.
Yeah.
And it can be got.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't be filling young people and kids up with this belief like they can't get it here in America.
Yeah.
There's so much opportunity if you just lean into the values that have always served us.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? So I was born in 87. And I tell you what, the shows that we watched, Family Matters, Urkel, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Cosby.
Yeah, you know, the rape kind of put a damper on it. But
it's factual, though.
Yeah, no, but Cosby was huge. Yeah. And then, of course, Will Smith was the biggest star when I was growing up. We didn't even think about it. And when you look at this today, I've talked about this. I don't think you'll ever have that again. Because now what do you have? You have TBS and Tyler Perry, and it's marketed toward black people. And then you have sort of white people content. Right? There isn't 20 million people tuning in to Fresh Prince and a majority white people. Now it's fragmented where it's like, okay, this is your entertainment and this is our entertainment. I didn't grow up with that. And actually one thing, so I want to get into sort of the history of black comedians, but one thing that you said last time you were on the show, and I honestly think you put a more effective, finer point on it than anyone did. And it's going to sound like I'm bragging because you sort of paid me a compliment. But I think it required an outside lens like yourself, an outside perspective, for me to be able to say, yeah, hey, I can't say that as a white guy, but you said, you know, people have gone after you saying that that joke is racist. And you said, in my experience, people who know that they are not racist are not nearly as mindful of trying to say the politically correct thing all the time because they don't have any worry that they're racist. In other words, if you tell a joke about a white guy, about an Asian guy, about a black guy, you said, people who are authentic don't fear racism around every corner. And I thought, yeah, you know, as a comedian growing up, you know, when I was 18, I remember I did an all black show one time. I opened for a guy named Bruce Bruce. Speaking of chubby black, you know, Bruce Bruce?
Of course.
It was black boy, two eyes, Bruce Bruce, and myself. And it was just in comedy, it was just like, look, you're funny or you're not. And of course, when I was there, it was nothing but racial jokes. The kind of jokes I couldn't tell at an audience outside of Bruce Bruce, nor would I want to. But I realized I was so out of place as a white guy that they were going, all right, what do you got? Acknowledge that this is a little bit off here. And at no point did anyone say, well, that was racist. It was something that was just, okay, we're all being authentic here. And I think that's an important point. I think the people who are inauthentic, who maybe do harbor some kind of racism, are the ones who try to put on a front that, well, you can't say this and you can say that. And I think there's no more pure example of this than comedy. People are going to get mad here, what I'm about to say. But if you look at the sort of new trend of all female comedians, you know, they're not very funny.
Yes, thank you.
Doesn't mean that women can't be funny.
Yeah.
One of my favorite comedians ever, Kathleen Madigan, one of my biggest inspirations ever, Joan Rivers, who I watched when I was a kid, and I watched her edit Just for Laughs Gala, changed my view of comedy. But back then it was, you better be good. Now, this is how I explain it to people. If you have an open mic night, right, with amateurs in comedy, let's say you have 10 spots. 40 white guys sign up, right? You're all competing for those spots. 15 white girls sign up. 15 women, black, white, whatever. You're going to have five and five. Five women and five guys. And guess what? You're pulling from a shallower talent pool. That's why women aren't as funny typically when you watch a special with women, because they go, look, we need 50% female comedians. You know where you don't see that? Black people. Black people have always been some of the best. If you look at the top comedians of all time, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone, say, anyone else other than Richard Pryor, maybe Carlin. And then right down that list in the top five, you're going to have Dave Chappelle, you're going to have Chris Rock, you're going to have Eddie Murphy. Because it wasn't, we need five black comics. It was, these guys are really funny. And when you look at, you know, like we talked about the black community and a strong history of passing down orally history. You look at black church, right, versus white church. You look at how black people interact with movies. It's a very verbal culture. That's a beautiful thing to me. And it lends itself to high, high quality comedy. But if back then we were saying, we need X amount of black people, I don't know that Richard Pryor would have been Richard Pryor.
I certainly know he wouldn't be Richard Pryor in this environment culture we have.
There's no way.
And you've hit on my, because I've been doing some stand-up at open mics at Zany's in Nashville.
Really?
Yeah, just because I think comedy's important. I think
hats off to you, though. That's scary to do.
Yeah, no, it's gone well twice. I bomb really bad once.
It happens. Get used to it.
But it's because I believe there's two things that can fix this. One, we got to return to Christ and our Christian values. But comedy is important for the protection of free speech. Comedians and ministers are the two people that are supposed to say unvarnished truth.
Yeah.
That unvarnished truth is hilarious. It's thoughtful. It's what has carried comedy. And we can't do it anymore. It's being illegalized. And so it's like the reason why I've got a little bit of a comedic part of me, but mostly it's just like I got the balls. I could care less. And I'm not going to let people, because I'm looking at Dave Chappelle get stopped. Dave Chappelle is not remotely woke, not in real life. He lives in rural Ohio in a mostly white community. He's married to an Asian woman. That's intentional, trust me, because there's a way he wants to be treated and respected as a man.
Let's circle back to that, but yes.
And so Dave Chappelle's not woke, and I'm looking at him pretend to be.
When he's going after Candace Owens, in that special. That was pretty rough.
Yeah, and just all of it. He's not saying what he really thinks because there's so much funny stuff happening on the left side that these comedians, black comedians, are leaving on the table. I'm going to give you an example because this is what my whole little comedy routine is based off. The last season of The Bachelor. We took an attractive white woman who went on national TV and said, I want to have sex with a black man for the rest of my life. And we labeled her racist because she wore a dress at a party when she was 18 or 19 years old. She's from the South. And again, I'm of a generation back when I was a kid, interracial dating was a big deal.
Yeah.
It's nothing now. But for a woman from the South, go on national TV in pursuit of a black husband, her daddy's watching that, her mama, her friends, everybody's watching that, and she's on a show crying, she's in love with a black man, and she went to some party where she wore a sundress, so therefore she's racist. I'm looking at, what's the black dude's name that was the bachelor? Dang, I can't think of his name.
I don't know.
But I'm like looking at him like he's suspect. Because any black dude I know would be like, hey, baby, bring that dress over here to my house. Don't have no panties on. And we're going to play Buck in the Big House.
All right. I'll have to ask you about that off air. But cultural differences, I guess. You guys have, that's the one thing. When I say, what do you mean you guys? I mean black people. You guys have all these interesting terms that white people don't have. Will you say bucket and bit house?
Buck in the big house.
Buck in the big house. See, we just say, we just have sex regular. White people. But
buck
again,
in the big house is Kunta Kinte when Massa's out of town and he's in the big house.
Okay.
It's about pleasuring.
It's about what I figured. And oh my gosh, we're gonna get letters for this. Wow. Look, it's context over content. So for example, we did a sketch. If you, at any given moment, you might see something that if you don't understand the context in the studio, you go, that's horrifying. One time I'm doing an interview, and behind the interviewer, there's someone rushing in a KKK outfit and rushing out. And I'm like, if someone saw this out of context, first off, it's an Asian intern. We were doing this sketch. The context is this, of the sketch. And maybe at the time that we're running this, maybe it's already aired, that I don't know if you know this about the KKK, but like, Grand Exalted Cyclops is a term, or like the Grand Wizard, all these. And we were sitting there one time, we were writing bits, comedy, and we said, do you think these guys were all just like Dungeons and Dragons nerds, and they didn't want people to know it, so they just faked they were racist because it was less embarrassing. So we did a whole sketch of Klansmen who were trying to play Dungeons and Dragons, but the wife going, "What are you guys? Are you guys playing Dungeons and Dragons out there? No, we're hating blacks and the Jews." And the context is they're not racist. It's but the point to it is to absolutely belittle and mock the KKK to render them powerless because these are stupid terms, and people who are in the KKK are stupid people. And I don't mean like stupid, like cool. I mean stupid. And that's a way to make a point, to mock the KKK. Because guess what? If you come out and say the KKK is bad, no one listens. We all know that. But if you get a few million people laughing at them, ooh, that gets racists actually mad.
That's the power of comedy. And they've stripped comedians of the right. And what I mean say right, of the right, not right political view. They've stripped them of the right to ridicule and undermine the influence of the legitimate racist bigots on the left.
Yeah.
And they take Colin Kaepernick. This is one of the things that got me in trouble with Fox Sports. I wanted to do a spoof of Colin Kaepernick in 2017, I believe, early.
Yeah.
I want to be like, now we need to expose this guy.
And the funny thing is, if you need to do a parody of Colin Kaepernick, you probably can't find a black guy to play him. You probably have to find like an Egyptian dude or something.
No, I found it was Chris Reed from Kid and Play.
Oh, okay.
The rapper. Kid, he's half black, half white, African as I call him. And I don't say I'm not trying to be derisive or whatever, but I got a lot of
it's funny, who cares?
Yeah, I got a lot of half black, half white friends. But anyway, I wanted to spoof Colin Kaepernick to show the idiocy and just like he's not, because the spoof was based off the fact that Nessa, his girlfriend, was actually controlling him. Colin Kaepernick is just a symbol. And so it was like, I don't know how much college football you watch, but
none.
They hold up signs on the sidelines with pictures of like, it'll be one big billboard and it'll have pictures of like eight different people. And it's a signal into the quarterback of what play to call. And so his girlfriend, Nessa, I would ask Kaepernick a question, and his girlfriend Nessa would hold up a sign signaling in the response.
Give him the answer.
To what I was asking.
Okay, that's funny.
Yeah,
it's a funny bit.
Yeah, they wouldn't let me run it.
Oh no!
On because the whole little Twitter universe got in an uproar because I tweeted out a picture of kid for Chris Reed with the Kaepernick afro on and a jersey.
Yeah,
and me, and I said, "Look who stopped by the studio today." Just that picture alone was enough to set the Twitter lynch mob off and enough to cause the executives to get skittish and fold. And so this is like, I wanted to like, hey man, we need to start ridiculing Colin Kaepernick early because this clown's going to have an amazing impact if we don't.
Yeah. Guess what? When you have these black activists out there like Colin Kaepernick who say, we need white allies. You don't want white allies because you don't want white people to comment on anything black. Unless it's exactly the opinion that's acceptable, otherwise you'll label it racist. And so white people are afraid to speak out. So they're afraid to be allies. And look, this is important. Like I was a perfect example of this, not even on the race side, but the gender side. It shocked me when you look at men playing women's sports, male to female transgender athletes. Most women are now against it, but they support it for a long time. The one demographic who said, no, we don't think that transgender male to female should be allowed in women's sports, we're men. Guess what? We don't have a dog in that fight because female to male are not going to come in and dominate men's weightlifting or men's wrestling. But feminists have said, if you have a penis, no opinion. So now men can't help women. And so they get their ass kicked in women's sports. It's the same thing. When you make people afraid to speak out and speak the truth, you lose allies.
You lose allies and you promote chaos, disorder, dysfunction. You have everybody at each other's throats. Again, if you eliminate the truth, you're setting everybody up to be at each other's throats and to want to destroy each other. And that's why comedians and ministers, I believe, are the two most important groups. And I would put broadcasters, those of us with some kind of public influence, third. But ministers and comedians are supposed to create the room for the rest of us
right.
speak truth. And it's just not happening. Ministers have become very political, and it's Obama in the black church is higher than Jesus, and Dave Chappelle has. I'm looking at Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock. These guys got plenty of money. Why can't I don't understand why they just don't? They got FU money,
right?
Why don't they act like it? It's bothering me. The thing that
I think because of legacy, like Chris Rock, you saw his comment where he said. You know, and he made a good point. He said, listen, when you look at with comedy, we don't need people to cancel us. You have a built the audience will let you know. The audience will let you know. You're saying you know better than the audience. And now some people will say, you're doing black voice. Like, that's black. No, it's a Chris Rock.
Yeah.
It's Chris Rock. But he said that. And then he said, but, you know, you might need to change with the times. Like, he was afraid to say it.
I agree with you about legacy. Because let's say Chappelle or Rock hopped on and just started going with the truth. Then the left that's in control of the media, when they put out their little list of the greatest comedians or whatever, Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle are going to fall, and then it's going to be written that, oh my God, they sided with the right-wing racist, and
right.
they're Trump supporters, and they're this and that, and now their legacy has been tarnished. And so all these guys, and their kids have to live with that legacy.
Right.
And so if their kids punch their name into Google and it comes up that Dave Chappelle hated black people and was Uncle Tom, and Dave don't want his kids looking at that.
Yeah.
I get it. But at some point, and this is why I keep making this appeal, is like, man, you got to stand on Jesus, man, and quit worrying about the history that a group of idiots and power corrupt, immoral people are going to write. And what about what Jesus thinks? And your eternal life, and look,
yeah.
maybe you don't believe in that, and so God help you, but
yeah.
you know, I certainly do,
yeah.
and a lot of the black people that I know and have been friends with and family, but we actually care about that, and man up.
Oh, and you know what else, too? People talk about toxic masculinity, what that really means, and look, I think we all agree there is toxic masculinity in the sense of, not the term toxic masculinity, but really what that is, when you talk about the negative qualities of men, where they talk about abuse or they talk about aggression or bullying, we're talking about cowardly men. Men who beat their wives are cowards, right? We're talking about godless, cowardly men. Who was the first man to say, be good to your wives? People get mad at Christianity. They go, oh, he said, wives, submit to your husbands. Under the agreement that men, be good to your wives, love your wives, be tender, cherish your wives. So when we talk about toxic masculinity, that's not innate. That's men's sinful nature, where a man is more physically powerful than a woman. And if a man abuses that power, that man is a bully, right? But one thing I will say, as far as actual sort of masculine archetypes, meaning the leader of the household, meaning final decision, meaning authoritative, it definitely speaks more like black Americans. That's something that is ingrained in the culture. Where I've always
disagree with you.
Really? Yeah. I've always found that with black people they respect powerful male, which I think is a big reason that Trump had a lot of appeal with black Americans.
I think it's within all men's nature. When we are men,
yes,
and so we're attracted to masculinity. We believe in, but for black people, since the Moynihan report that came out, I think in 63 or something, and Lyndon Johnson rejected the Moynihan report. Daniel Moynihan or Patrick Moynihan, Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
Lyndon Johnson was an actual racist, by the way.
But yes. He was commissioned to do a study, and he came out with his study, and it was about investing in the black family, that we're at a critical time, and we need to invest in the black family. Lyndon Johnson rejected that.
Yep.
And went the completely different other direction.
Model cities.
And yeah, the Great Society. And we're going to basically, it was, didn't state it, but it was going to destroy the black
family. We're going to incentivize not getting married.
Yes. And so, because of that decision, and there was a crossword, were we going to go invest in the black family, or are we going to go into the destruction of it? The destruction of it has created the black matriarch. We have a matriarchal culture and society among black people.
Yeah, that's true, definitely. And I think a big part of that is also because you have a lot of fathers who aren't in the home.
Yeah.
But I'm saying black women tend to, I guess you also probably haven't been in the what, like white liberal guys' huddles. Like the men are castrated. Black women are still attracted to powerful men. Whereas that's often seen as a negative in the white community now, where it's, you know, sit down, shut up, and listen, and don't speak out. And I don't think you see that as much.
Yeah, here's what you see. Repeat those words. Sit down, shut up,
yeah,
and don't speak, or yeah, something like that. That's what black women now say to black men.
Well, they haven't been to a black movie theater. No one sits down and shuts up.
You hear black women talking mostly. I'm just telling you.
Well, that's probably true.
No, I'm just telling you. We have a matriarchal culture, society. I experienced this personally.
Yeah.
I hope my mother doesn't watch this, but it's at the root of tension between me and my mother.
Mm.
I don't say this. I say this as a devoted son. My mother is one of the greatest. Other than Mary, I don't know a better mother than what I had. But she's a matriarch.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the ultimate patriarch. And since I've been paying your bills and everything for 25 years, me and my mother clash. She wants to be the matriarch. I don't allow
it. She does, but if your mom, let me ask you this, if your mom were to pick a man, like a suitor, I don't know if she's in a relationship or something.
Divorced from my father, never remarried. And most of it because she wants to be the boss. She's not a candidate.
But she's not going to pick a hipster in horn-rimmed glasses and a onesie, is my point. Like, they're still attractive.
She might.
She might.
No, I'm just, she's 82 really? Now, 81. But my mother's going to be.
That doesn't
the
mean
boss.
She doesn't still have needs.
I got it. I get that. You're talking about, that's called a maintenance man. What kind of maintenance man she might choose is different from a husband.
Right.
Or someone she could partner with. My mother wants to be the boss.
Yeah.
Period. All of her friends, her sister, they're all matriarchs. And again, this is what I like about, and we haven't even brought him up, but like this Kwame Brown kid that's made all this noise early spring, this part of the summer, is he's been pointing this out and provoking a larger discussion about the relationship between men and women and maybe it was Kevin Samuels, but somebody just made the point that being this super strong woman, as a mother, you might be creating weak men. And so in the black community, there's a big conversation among us as men, like, man, our culture and men have become very emotional and very effeminate. They're modeling, again, it's, nobody wants to sit down and have a debate and a discussion. Everybody just wants to get angry and emotional and lean into their emotion. And I'm like, that ain't manly. That's not. It's like, I'm used to dealing with emotion, but not from men, where you can't control your emotion. Let's sit down and talk about this chess game and not get emotional about it.
Yeah.
This ain't a game of checkers where you just slam the chips down, they splatter everywhere. And I may be called
checkers with you.
Yeah. I may be called sexist or whatever, but that's a level of behavior that I expect from women, to be quite honest with you, the emotion and feelings and all that being more important than facts and logic. I don't expect that from a man.
Whoa. I can't believe that you just implied that women are more emotional creatures than men.
Yes, I did.
I know, that's ooh, maybe we'll end on that, because that's the kind of, that can get into some slippery territory. You might be wearing a hood next, but look, here's one thing I will say, to go back to this at a cigar lounge. When I talk with women and men, and you know what's funny? You almost never see white women smoking cigars. I do see black women smoking cigars more than white women smoking cigars, and you see a lot of black men smoking cigars. Outside of like in the 80s, you know, the models, like Demi Moore would take a picture with one when there was the boom and fake it. But it's always a good starting point, I will say, bridging the racial divide, never with politics, with a stranger. But I've had a lot of conversations when you go to a cigar lounge, just because you happen to be sitting next to black people, white people, it's really communal. And almost always you start talking about church. You know, I start talking about church, you start talking about faith, and that builds a bridge. And then it segues into politics sometimes, and it never becomes a screaming match because you're starting off with common ground. So that cigar sometimes is a great unifier, and it allows you to open up in that common ground. Usually, again, one that you can agree on that I've found is most successful is our faith, that bedrock, that foundation. and I've had some of the best conversations of my life. All right, we're going to go to Mug Club exclusive here a little bit. You can talk about Kwame more, but the show is Fearless with Jason Whitlock, right, on The Blaze.
Yep.
That's where you guys can go and find it. And if you want to watch more where he starts going off on women being more emotional, and you know, maybe he'll talk about how white men can't jump. All right, I'm going to level with you. If you liked this video, you have to hit the share button. Otherwise, your entire family will die. I don't write the rules. I just call them. And this is clipped from the live show every Monday through Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern. That's the best thing you can do to watch live. I mean, you know, you ran afoul. Your family's dead.
My family is dead, but my mother left me with this shirt before she went home to meet the Lord.
Oh, well, I guess we all come out winners.